Hi, and welcome to Green Deal Big Deal, the podcast where we discuss Europe's green future. My name is Eva Iwaszuk.
And I'm Aaron Best. We're pleased to join you today from the offices of Ecologic Institute in Berlin.
So, Aaron, this is the last episode of Green Deal Big Deal for now. We have initially planned this show as this limited run of 15 episodes.
15 episodes.
Indeed. We do hope to raise further funding to continue the series. So we ask our listeners to stay subscribed for future episodes, but this is it for now. Are you feeling emotional about this being our last episode?
Well, it's been a lot of fun. I'm going to miss our time together here behind the mic.
Absolutely.
Talking to our guests. You remember the first episode we had where we built that cave out of temporary walls?
Yes, and we used some blankets and carpets to isolate the sound. So I feel like we've definitely gone a long way into making this podcast a little bit more professional.
Yeah, those were the days. But now it's episode 15. We're still here. And in today's episode, we will discuss the expansion of the EU's emission trading system to cover buildings and transport. Emissions trading is one of the EU's essential policy instruments for reducing CO2 emissions in a fair and efficient way. If you're not familiar with emissions trading, don't worry. We'll cover the basics at the beginning of our discussion before we dive into the details.
Exactly. And to help us understand the history, the present, and the future of emissions trading, and especially the recent policy developments in the EU, we have with us Sibyl Stoiber, who is the head of the Berlin office of the Buildings Performance Institute Europe, as well as our colleague Matthias Duwe, who heads Ecologic Institute's climate team. Sibyl and Matthias, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yes, thank you.
So, Matthias, my first question is for you. Today, we're discussing the expansion of the EU emissions trading system, EU ETS for short, to include buildings and transport under the so-called ETS2. But to help us set the scene for our discussion of ETS2, could you please explain the concept of emissions trading? How and where has it been implemented as well? Give our listeners a bit of an idea of the big picture.
Thank you so much, Aaron. I'd be happy to. And let me say at the start, what an honor it is to be on the pod. And I wish you much success for the second run. The key thing here to keep in mind is basically what's the objective here. And for all climate policy, the goal is to reduce emissions. And for the long-term changes that we want to achieve, getting us to a climate neutral future, we need to change our economic structures, which are currently heavily reliant on fossil fuels, and also change the way that we do things, make adjustments in our current daily behaviors. And in order to guide the economy and society towards that, policymakers have a range of instruments in their toolbox. And one of these is emissions trading. It's an economic instrument, that works through prices. And the basic idea is that you change the behavior or the investment decisions by changing the economics for the individual or the company concerned. So the activity or the outcome that you want to change gets a price tag and becomes a factor in the decisions. That's the theory. How does this work in practice?
What is actually traded? I'm interested in, we call it trading, but what's actually traded?
Sure. I would say that a more accurate name for emissions trading would actually be a cap and trade system. Emissions trading is the more commonly known term, and it's not entirely wrong, but it's somewhat inaccurate. And to understand how it works, it's important to think about these two components that you need, the cap and the trading, because the cap is basically the fact that you establish a maximum level of emissions at the start. It's defined for a given group and for a given time, say, for all of the power plants in a given country, say, Germany, where I'm based right now, and for a single year. You decide that there's a maximum volume of emissions that these plants are allowed to emit. And then for each of these emission units, which is in this case then a ton of CO2, these plants need to show a corresponding permit or allowance. And for these to be traded, there needs to be a value to them, right? If you have something in abundance, why everybody's got enough, there's no need to trade with anyone, and there's not really price on it. So you need to have what economists call scarcity. There need to be fewer permits than actual emissions. And of course, for climate policy and our climate policy goals, it's super important that emissions go down further and further over time. And a cap that you're setting should go down over time.
And what are the benefits of an emissions trading system compared to something like the carbon tax?
Taxation basically means that you can do carbon pricing, but it's different what you fix at the start. With the tax, you fix the price, and then you're hoping that that price will change behavior in a way that you're reducing emissions, but you don't know by how much you're reducing the emissions. And the difference with an emissions trading, or in fact, as I said, cap and trade system, is you fix the environmental goal. And so if the policy is actually carried out and implemented, then you're sure about the environmental change, the emissions reductions that you're getting. You don't know upfront what the price is going to be. But the benefit is that by trading, and therefore the letting the market figure out which of the companies that are participating can make the reductions at the lowest cost, you're overall getting the price or the money that's needed to make these reductions done at the lowest cost point. So overall, the cheapest way, if you will, of getting that reduction done.
Great. Thank you for that background. One more piece of background that I think would be useful before we get into ETS2 is to talk about the EU ETS briefly, the EU emissions trading system. Could you just sketch a little bit of the history that would be helpful for our conversation today?
Yeah, I think in this context, it's important to know that the EU emissions trading system, EU ETS, has been around for almost 20 years now. It started in 2005, initially with a trial phase of 3 years that was really important to have as a learning experience and also to get some proper emissions data from all over the EU, because we didn't have really detailed information at the start on which emission sources were exactly where and how much were they emitting. The system started with a coverage of emissions from the power sector. So all of the electricity production with emissions, meaning in particular coal and gas power plants. But then there were also larger industrial emission sources included. So that's really the production of steel and cement. And then it's expanded over time to include other industries, also some non-CO2 gases, non-carbon dioxide gases, and then emissions from certain flights, for example, were added. Actually, transport is already covered to a certain extent. Airplane travel is included in the system, certainly for flights inside the EU. And if you look at what that means overall, you know, at the start, it was said that the ETS was covering around half of the EU's climate emissions. And now, though, that share has gone down over time because the emissions from the sectors covered have gone down over time. There have been reductions in power emissions significantly and also reductions in industry.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, that's actually a very interesting trend to understand. So, Sybil, as part of the European Green Deal, this emissions trading scheme has recently been extended to cover additional sectors that were not originally included. Could you please outline the main elements of ETS2 for our listeners?
Yes, and thank you, Matthias, again, to point out that the ETS2 is building actually on a policy instrument that proved working for 20 years almost, and it's working similarly. So it's also putting a cap on CO2 emissions, but really on the fuel combustions in the buildings and transport sector mainly, and covers additional smaller industry sectors that are not covered yet by the emissions trading scheme. So it's complementary, and the cap is derived from the so-called effort sharing regulation. So that's the targets for the climate protection in the EU for those sectors that are not yet covered by the emissions trading scheme. And one particularity and difference from the EU ETS is here that we have an upstream ETS in the ETS2, which means that it's not the users that really take part in the emissions trading scheme. So it's not the final customer, the household, that take part in the emissions trading scheme, but those companies that sell fuels for transport and fuels for heating and bring those fuels into the market. So we have gasoline suppliers, coal suppliers, mineral oil industry that take part in the emissions trading scheme, and they have to hold those allowances for every ton of CO2 they bring and sell into the market via their fuels. And then they are allowed to pass on the price to the final customer. So that's how this then turns into a price mechanism for the final customer.
Okay, so we will definitely want to dive a little bit more deeply into the implications this policy mechanism will have for the decarbonization of the building sector. But first, Matthias, on the transport side, could you briefly tell us how that will work under ETS2 and what are the implications that transport companies or motorists can expect?
Well, as Sibyl already explained, the way that the ETS2 is being organized, it's not individual motorists that are doing the trading. That in theory would have been a possibility, but in a much more complex system to implement. So essentially, they only see the impact of the carbon pricing on the fuel price, basically. Whenever they go and fill up their cars, that's what they see. And so the question is, are they actually realizing that there is this additional factor in the price they're seeing at the pump? Because there are many factors that determine these prices of fuel. Most listeners will be well familiar with the changes that you can see in these prices even over a single weekend. We saw significant price increases actually through the energy price crisis around the Russian invasion of the Ukraine. Few euro cents in fuel price change from an ETS may not really be changing behavior. And I think that's really quite critical to understanding how, you know, effective this policy can be for this sector, because on its own, you know, it will not be enough to trigger the changes that we need to see for the climate goals to be achieved.
So Sibyl, Matthias just covered transport, but buildings have some specific characteristics that make them quite a different challenge than decarbonizing the power generation sector, for example. Could you please explain some of the unique challenges for our listeners when it comes to buildings?
Yes, I think that's very important to understand that we're dealing with a sector that is fragmented in many ways in terms of actors, in terms of also building infrastructure. So we have a heterogeneous owner landscape. On the one hand, there are large building owners that understand how the buildings perform that they own. We have owner-occupied single-family buildings. We see in Central and Eastern Europe large building stock, many multifamily apartments that are owner-occupied. We see other countries where we have single-family buildings in the countryside, and we have countries where we have a high share of tenants. For example, in Germany, there are many more tenants compared to owners of dwellings. So here is the so-called split incentive dilemma very present. The landlord can invest, the tenant cannot take investment decisions to really save energy and reduce the energy demand in buildings. Then we have different climatic zones. We have different infrastructural preconditions. We have countries with a lot of district heating that is largely covered under the EU emissions trading scheme, for example, Denmark and Sweden. Then we have a large share of decentralized heating systems in countries such as Hungary and Poland and Germany. They are much more affected by a price on the ETS2. And then we have long investment cycles also. So it's not natural to react easily and fastly to prices. So we have a building envelope that is during its lifetime changes like maybe we touched once or twice only. And there's many, many non-economic barriers for homeowners to really take investments into the buildings, which starts with really incomplete information about opportunities, how much it costs, how to access finance. And last but not least, there are multiple benefits of energy renovation, which are not priced in a CO2 price. And all of this really renders the building sector to be really bit more difficult to tackle solely with an economic and price-based instrument.
Yes, it sounds a lot more complex, a lot more diverse in terms of the picture. Does the ETS2 address those aspects well in your view? Maybe you can speak about a few things that you think are well addressed and maybe some aspects that are still escaping good policy regulation.
I mean, there are two main strategies to decarbonize the building sector. One is to decarbonize the supply side, so switch fuels from fossil fuel heating to renewable heating. And the other strategy is to reduce the energy demand of a building through renovation and changing the building's equipment and rendering that more efficient. So we have these two strategies, and the ETS, by putting a price on the energy on the fuel that is burned has a direct effect on the fuel supply. So we have direct incentives here, and we've seen that in countries such as Sweden. That is a country who has established CO2 prices for a while and has already reached CO2 prices of 114 euros per ton of CO2 already. And we've seen a fuel switch here, but we have not really observed any improvements of the building envelope here. A price can have an effect if it's high enough on the fuel switch, but less so on the decarbonization of the building envelope through energy saving measures. That's one thing. And one other thing that is probably a great advantage of an emissions trading scheme is that it creates revenues through the auctions that then can be spent for decarbonizing the sectors and put into very specific measures to complement what the CO2 price only cannot achieve.
Okay, and you mentioned there, Sybil, the auctions that are part of the mechanism where these permits are even first given out to those in the sector. So, Matthias, what's your view on how well ETS2 can address these challenges that Sybil has brought up? Do you agree, disagree with those points that she's raised?
I think the thing to keep in mind here is that an emissions trading system on its own will indeed sometimes face limits to its effectiveness. I was given the example for transport earlier that it is questionable, say, if the increase in the fuel price at the pump will really be visible, whether the system will give individuals a sense of an increase in the price over time so that will really get them to change their behavior. I think what's key to consider is that it does require complementary policies for the ETS to work effectively. And, there are three essential ways here to consider. One is to reduce other incentives and subsidies that are actually still around for use of fossil fuel vehicles, which basically are contradictory to the price signal from the ETS2. The second is you need to have alternatives for people to use. So other means of transport also need policy support and funding, bicycle lanes, buses, trains, but also other types of engines such as electric motors and the required infrastructure for it. And the third is getting rid of some of the polluting options and technologies as well. And that's part, in fact, of the EU policy package that the ETS2 is a part of, that there is an additional element in the transport sector for a quite stringent emissions performance standard for vehicles. So essentially, as of 2035, no new car sold in the EU can directly emit CO2 anymore. So only zero emission vehicles can be sold. And so, in combination, if you're basically bringing these three elements together, then ETS2 can also work for transport.
Sybil, Matthias raised the topic of complementary policies. In the building sector, how does ETS2 fit into that sort of broader set? What are those other policies that are also helping?
We see that the emissions trading, by putting a price on the carbon, is actually helping to render other policy instruments cost effective. So whenever you have a minimum standard for energy performance of buildings, whenever you have support schemes, any investment that is there will become more cost efficient and reduce the payback period if you have a CO2 price on the fuel. So I think that's important, that the CO2 emissions trading scheme in the building sector is helping other policy instruments to become effective. And you need a broad mix of policy instruments to really address all those non-economic barriers that I mentioned before, and to make sure that investments actually happen where they need to be happened. So we need both a fuel decarbonization, but we also need energy saving measures. And so we have to make sure that both work in parallel and we address these different actors through different types of policy instruments.
And Sybil, both you and Matthias have touched to some extent on some of the challenges and controversies that are related to this extension of the EU ETS, which is the fact that in case of buildings and transport sectors, especially, even if the consumers do not directly take part in the trading, the price does get passed on to consumers. And also, for instance, you mentioned the long investment cycles in the building sector, which means that we all need to heat our homes, and it's not that easy to change the heating fuel in many cases. And that leads to the fact that the policy change might disproportionately affect low-income households. I wanted to ask you, how does the ETS2 reconcile this need for decarbonization, reducing emissions, with the concerns about housing affordability and social equity?
Yes, I mean, through the ETS2, the so-called Social Climate Fund has been established to make sure that parts of the revenues that are gained through the auctioning of emissions are collected to be redistributed for especially vulnerable households. In total, I think it's 65 billion euros that is distributed in the next years between 2027 and 2032 for dedicated programs for vulnerable households, for smaller companies that especially suffer from a higher CO2 price, and to enable them to really address structurally the problem, high fuel consumption, thus helping them to reduce their energy demand and helping them to switch the fuel.
So, Sybil, how do you assess this proposed social climate fund? Do you think it's an effective tool to address those social equity concerns?
I think it's super important to have this mechanism in place to redistribute funds, to redirect them to the citizens and make sure that the money is invested in structural measures and long-lasting measures to reduce the energy demand in buildings and support the fuels. That is, first of all, an important point. How this works in practice and if the mechanism that is put in place works smoothly, we will have to find out. I think it's important that programs put in place that address vulnerable households and small companies. And I think that's what the Social Climate Fund does, that it puts preconditions to really direct the funds to those clients, to those actors. And it allows also for some price subsidies to a limited extent. I think that could be one additional measure. But I think what we see also from other countries who have CO2 price mechanisms in place is that a redistribution, a revenue recycling, paying it back directly to final consumers also helps in order to render the whole scheme more socially fair.
So I have a question for both of you. While the EU ETS, the first system, focused on industry and the power sector, the ETS2 is a bit closer to consumers, you know, the heating costs for buildings, transport costs. So they might feel a bit more directly affected than in the first system. What would you say to consumers who might be skeptical about such a policy?
First off, I would say that I understand the concerns that people have about these policies affecting their own prosperity, that they may be afraid of changes, and also that they may be concerned about the magnitude of the changes that may be required here. But at the same time, I would say to them, do make an honest assessment, check your own behavior. There is room for change. Can you make fewer trips? Can you use alternative transport? Can you save energy in your own home? We have seen that was possible with the fuel consumption for heating, for example, going down significantly in the winter of 2022-2023, when everybody was aware of the price increases, but also the security concerns. It may be a different matter to be thinking about investments, as we've already talked about, in, say, a new heating system or a different car, for example, electric car. Not everybody can afford that. But again, you know, check your options, make it a conscious decision. Assume that the costs are going to go up for the old technology. So, you know, look for support programs by your government and offers from your local bank to help you make it possible. And if I may add one more thing, talk to your politicians. You know, make them create an overall package that will provide these affordable alternatives and some compensation where it is needed to avoid, you know, really negative impacts on the poorer parts of society.
And Sybil, what would you say to consumers?
Yeah, I agree largely on what Matthias said. I think there may be two more things I would like to stress. Yes, of course, at least looks like a burden, but it also gives a clear message that if you take action early on and invest in sustainable building infrastructure, you will be protected for price fluctuations in the future. That's one thing. And the other one is that investments really pay off in multiple ways. So you increase the value of the building, you increase health and comfort, you increase the independence of fossil fuel for a supply, and of course, you reduce the costs over long term.
I think we're also looking at a bigger issue here, because ultimately these changes are somewhat fundamental and I think require a comprehensive vision that people can also buy into. Know and understand the reason for a policy, then they are much more likely to support it and willing to accept the consequences. And I think this is in part that with these policies that are now coming closer to affecting and having implications for people's everyday lives, you know, whereas beforehand, changes in power generation where we may be more abstract, you still got the electricity out of your socket at home and you didn't really notice. Now we do need to have more of a societal consensus on the shift to a climate neutral economy and what that means. And the experience in Germany over the last year, for example, you know, shows how hard that can be. Now we've seen there was a policy being debated for a shift to climate-friendly heating systems, and there were real problems with the communication about this and the way that the policy was perceived in the eyes of consumers, to which it didn't seem to be fair. But there's also then again the broader issue of needing to form a consensus across parties, because we had, you know, quite partisan politics around this and campaigning that showed that there was quite a conflict between parties. And at this point, I think we're lacking that kind of common vision for the transition that we need.
So the EU has set this policy target of achieving a climate neutral economy by 2050. Matthias, what's your view regarding the contribution of ETS2 overall to achieving there? How important is it for the EU and its member states to achieving the 2050 target?
You know, at the start, I talked about how carbon pricing, you know, can be a really useful instrument in the policy toolbox, and it sure is. And that also goes for putting a price on the carbon in the fuels for the way that are needed to heat our homes and move our vehicles, etc. But at the same time, on its own, the policy isn't enough. We need to have the ETS2 be part of a package where also the alternatives are being provided and where the old technologies are being phased out. And recently read news that, for example, the European People's Party in their manifesto for the elections for the European Parliament in June 2024 are considering a reversal of this combustion engine, fossil fuel combustion engine ban, the vehicle performance standards. And, you know, if we don't have these other components, then maybe the role of the ETS2 becomes even more important, but it will also be diminished in its effectiveness if there aren't these other contributing instruments around as well.
We are nearing the end of our interview, and we like to ask our guests at the end about their policy recommendations and future forward-looking ideas. I would like to start with you, Sybil. In light of what we discussed today, what do you think, which additional policies or incentives are needed to accelerate decarbonizations in the building sector?
I think we need clear incentives and minimum requirements for the building sector to help anyone that wants to invest and that owns a building where to put that investment and what is expected from its building in terms of energy performance in 2050. And coming along with that, we need financial support to make this happen. Matthias mentioned that we have to make sure that there are alternatives available that can be picked and implemented. That's important. Therefore, we need to invest in innovation and innovative processes and practices, which is important. We see now a lot of renovation processes and standardization here to make them faster, less invasive for citizens, for households. And that is, I think, something that we need to continue investing in. We need to make sure that financial support is really guided to the most vulnerable groups instead of covering each and everyone. And I would say that it's really important to roll out a wide infrastructure of support in order to guide households to take investment decisions in the right way. And not only to start with an initial advice, but really helping them accessing funds and making sure that they have access to finance. And this has been done in several European member states through so-called one-stop shops. And I really think that's an important instrument to support citizens to implement the necessary transformation.
Indeed, and as you mentioned before, that is something that is necessary in this very fragmented landscape of building owners and building types. Matthias, anything to add from your side as you look forward to the future of emissions trading in the EU?
It's a very dynamic policy area. As an instrument, emissions trading is also being considered for other sectors that are currently not covered, such as for agricultural emissions. And there is also a process in place or ongoing already at EU level to create certificates or certified carbon dioxide removals. And then the question is, would they also become tradable if they are certified? Will you be able to count removals against emissions, for example, as part of your obligations under emissions trading system? So there is a lot happening in the policy discourse. I think the key question with all of these ideas is that we need to apply the same considerations that we've been mentioning in the conversation here. Is emissions trading for the specific purpose really, is it the right tool? Are there others that may be more effective? Or what is its function in an overall policy mix that can get us to net zero in the sectors concerned? And beyond that, I think, again, this is what we need as a complement or an overarching framework for all of it is, again, work at a common vision of the changes needed so that we're bringing citizens and bringing the stakeholders that need to actually implement all of these changes, that we need to bring them along.
Sybil and Matthias, thank you very much for joining us today on Green Deal, Big Deal.
Thank you also from my side.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, thanks a lot, Aaron and Eva.
So, Eva, that was episode 50.
Indeed.
And we had a very interesting discussion about emissions trading. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I am very glad that we had this conversation at the end of our season, because I think in many ways it sums up a lot of the ideas we covered in the podcast. One of them is the fact that you need to really look at the whole picture. You need to look holistically. So what we talked about today, the emissions trading, the basic idea is that you make it expensive to emit carbon, and through that you change behaviors of different actors. Initially, it was industry, power generation. Now it's sectors that are a bit closer to consumers. So you also want to change the consumer behavior in a way. But it's very important to understand what this behavior can change to. And one big idea that stands out for me for this conversation is how important good alternatives are. So we talked in episode 13 about New European Bauhaus and the idea of making the transition to climate neutral economy a delightful experience. And obviously it can only be delightful if you have those great alternatives that are environmentally friendly, that are carbon neutral, but that also make you happy to use them. So I lived in 4 different European cities, and in some of them using public transport was nice and easy and smooth and pleasant. And in some of them you felt like a martyr wherever you try to get from point A to B with a bus. So I think this idea of having good alternatives and the policymakers considering that before pushing consumers to change behavior is something very important.
Yeah, I totally agree. There is such a thing as useful repetition. And so I will repeat what you said, because I think it is so central, the importance of offering alternatives. If we just raise the price on carbon and there's nowhere else to go, then all we've done is raise the price and people are paying more. But if we have alternative things that people can move to and they're attractive, well thought out, then that makes a big difference. So I agree with you absolutely there. And emissions trading really is just one piece of a much larger, broader policy puzzle. One thing that Sybil brought in is really important, I think, is how unique the building sector is in terms of its particular challenges. And the one that always keeps coming to my mind is the fact that it's the building owner that has the capital costs of investing and saving energy and things like that. And it's the person who's renting, if it's a rental building, that gets the benefits in terms of all the money saved. And that's a real incentive problem, right? Is why should the landlord do it if the renter is the one who's going to get all the benefits? So, and also the capital costs required, the longevity of those investments, how slow moving things can be in that sector. That was really important.
Yeah, absolutely. And then when we're talking about those misaligned incentives, probably that's where some subsidy programs are quite essential to make that push. I think when it comes to the unique challenges of the building sector, one thing that I also learned from the conversation today is this issue of fragmentation. So basically we have the building stock consists of single family homes, of large buildings. We have district heating. We have heating that is like placed in the building. And that makes policy for the whole sector absolutely difficult to conceive, conceptualize, implement, roll out. So I think that's something that we have to consider as well and understand. That is why we need so many of those policy puzzle pieces.
Yeah, so in sustainable development, we talk about economics, we talk about the social side, we talk about the environmental side. And in our discussion today, it was very clear this tight relationship between the social equity side of things and the environmental policy side of things. So, you know, what to do with the revenue that is raised by the emissions trading, how to get that in a targeted way to disadvantaged groups to help them make this transition possible in terms of these sectors that are more difficult to decarbonize. And they are more difficult. That's why this policy regime is coming in sort of second. That's why it's ETS2 as opposed to the EU ETS. You know, it's more difficult, more complex to do with more of these trade-offs. One thing I thought that was really interesting, and I did not know this before our podcast today, the ETS used to cover over half of the EU's emissions.
Mm-hmm.
And because of its effectiveness, it no longer does cover over half. I think that was, I don't know, that stuck with me.
Yes, indeed. So I think that it does show that the emissions trading can be effective. And to some extent that this carbon pricing is an important piece of the puzzle. So you need to provide alternatives, but you also need to make it expensive to emit fossil fuels, to use fossil fuels.
Yeah, I think it's important to say that the reason for making it expensive is not just to make it expensive, it's that emitting CO2 really has a cost for society, especially future generations. And the people who are making choices today, if they don't understand about that or experience that cost themselves, you know, they will impose it on other people. And that's an unfair situation. So it's about correcting that fairness, about getting a real true price signal in. And like we've discussed, the importance of being able to shift to climate-friendly alternatives is really key.
That was said as a true economist, Aaron.
Yeah, sometimes it wells up from somewhere deep within my heart.
Exactly. An economist that also tries to, you know, communicate without using words as externalities. So I congratulate you.
Yeah. I thought one of the really interesting things that Matthias said in his closing comment that stuck with me, and I'm really going to think about this, he really expressed a thoughtful empathy with the situation that some people are going to face in the climate transition and about what we need to do to help address that. And, you know, we're seeing a lot of concern in some sectors of society that are feeling some of the pinch points. We've talked about this in the Just Transition podcast. You know, that was a really just the central issue there. But that balanced perspective, you know, really thinking about that carefully, even if you're very interested in environmental concerns, as we should be, thinking about the whole society perspective and groups that are maybe disadvantaged, maybe discontent, and how to bring everybody along in this very necessary social transition.
Yeah, I think that's a very important message. And I think that also sums up a lot that we tried to discuss here on this podcast. So I think that's a great wrap up to this episode. Thank you for tuning into the last episode of the season of our show. We hope this episode helped you understand the issue of emissions trading and its expansion to cover buildings and transport. You can find other episodes of this podcast on all major podcast platforms and apps, including Spotify, Apple, and Deezer, as well as on YouTube. Please subscribe to the podcast to find any future episodes we'll produce in your feed. Stay connected with us via Instagram at Green Deal Big Deal. Our website is greendealbigdeal.eu.
This podcast is part of the European Environment Initiative, funded by the Federal Ministry for the Environment, Nature Conservation, Nuclear Safety, and Consumer Protection. The ministry supports this initiative on the basis of a decision adopted by the German Bundestag. The podcast is produced by Chiara Mazzetti, Eva Iwaschuk, Ricardo Faber and Aaron Best. Sound design by Lena Abley. Graphic and web design by Jennifer Rahm. Special thanks to Johannes Seilnacht, Liliana Zala, Leonardo Wicke, Camilla Bausch, and Michael Lawrence.